From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. So far, American casualties in the war have been remarkably light, and we're optimistic that the war will be over soon. But it hasn't been a clean, easy war for the people of Baghdad. On today's Fresh Air, novelist Amitav Ghosh worries about an Egyptian friend in Baghdad. Also, retired Admiral Eugene Carroll discusses the complexity of surrender and how history shows us that unconditional surrender is not always a good thing, even for the victors. And how good could we feel about a victory in the Gulf when we've got so many problems at home? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Halberstam ponders the question. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Portions of Kuwait City are now free from Iraqi occupation, and there are reports of wild celebrations in the streets. A large tank battle raged earlier today on the outskirts of the city, but ended inconclusively as night fell. NPR's David Malpas has more.
Pentagon officials say Allied troops have not yet entered Kuwait City in large numbers, but special forces units are probing the city, trying to pinpoint Iraqi troop locations. More probing actions are anticipated through the night, and fighting to retake the entire area is expected to resume by daylight. Pentagon Operations Chief General Thomas Kelly says a major tank battle took place earlier near the airport, with U.S. Marines leading the fight, but he couldn't say who now controls the airport.
That's undetermined right now. Tomorrow is going to come. When the sun comes up, the question in my mind will the enemy still be there? But it had gotten dark, and both sides broke off. I would tell you that the U.S. forces in that area are getting pretty tired right now. They've been attacking constantly for 3 days, so they probably need a little rest.
U.S. officials say when they do enter the city in force, they'll do so cautiously to avoid civilian casualties. I'm David Malpas reporting.
U.S. officials said today that the U.S. and Allied troops have reached the Euphrates River, cutting off the retreat of Iraq's Republican Guard. The Republican Guard has been a military concern throughout the crisis, since it's considered to be Saddam Hussein's most experienced, best equipped, and most loyal fighting force. U.S. military officials said the Guard isn't completely encircled on land, but that Allied air power should be able to prevent it from retreating toward the southern Iraqi city of Basra. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has been charged with helping to organize the rebuilding of Kuwait. Today, it selected some 36 construction firms. NPR's Michael Richards reports.
Whether it's repairing buildings, patching airport runways, or laying pipes for municipal waterworks, there's millions of dollars in contracts to be awarded just in the initial emergency stages of the Kuwaiti reconstruction plan. The Army Corps of Engineers has been hired by the Kuwaiti government to coordinate this initial work. And today, the Corps selected 36 finalists who'll have 2 days to put in final bids to do construction jobs. The winning bidders will hear by the weekend, and the work could start almost immediately. There's been tension inside the anti-Iraq alliance because it initially appeared that U.S. firms were getting the lion's share of the work. But the list of finalists is only one-third American. British and Saudi companies are also well represented. With many economies in a slump, the competition is stiff for the business opportunities created by the Kuwaiti reconstruction effort. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
Stock prices fell today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 23 points to close at 2,864.6. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-1 in active trading. Volume on the New York Exchange was 164 million shares. This is NPR. The American Civil Liberties Union has asked a federal appeals court to act quickly to set aside a Pentagon ban on news coverage and public access to the return of Gulf War dead to the United States. The ACLU is representing a group of journalists and critics of the war. The group wants access to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, where the bodies of war dead are brought when they're returned from the Gulf. A U.S. district judge has denied a temporary restraining order that would have required the Pentagon to let the public and the news media in while the matter is being decided. More than 30 National Guardsmen have been disciplined for having gone absent without leave this month at Fort Hood, Texas. The soldiers said they left the Army base to protest their treatment during training. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Texas.
The protest involved 67 National Guardsmen from Shreveport, Louisiana. All had been activated to train for Operations Desert Shield and Storm, and all were listed as away without leave 3 weeks ago. Most returned to their posts at Fort Hood, Texas after a few days. Army spokesmen say half the group has now been disciplined. The spokesman wouldn't detail the punishment, except to say it might include reductions in rank, forfeiture of pay, or extra duty. None of the soldiers were court-martialed or jailed. 34 soldiers still face disciplinary action. One is still listed as AWOL. Some of the guardsmen say they left their posts because training was unnecessarily tough, leaves had been shortened or revoked, and morale was low. I'm Howard Berkus in Killeen, Texas.
The State Department presented Congress today with an administration foreign aid plan priced at almost $15 billion. Aid to Israel would remain the same in the next fiscal year, with a combination of military and economic assistance worth about $3 billion. Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. aid, followed by Egypt, whose assistance also remains steady at $2.27 billion. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Throughout the war, Allied casualties have been reported as extremely low. For the most part, civilians in Allied countries have not been at risk. But civilians in Iraq and Kuwait have endured considerable suffering. When the war in the Gulf ends, thousands of people around the world will be trying to reestablish contact with family members and friends in Kuwait and Iraq. In last month's issue of the British literary magazine Granta, Indian novelist and anthropologist Amitav Ghosh wrote about an Egyptian friend of his who was working in Baghdad when the war broke out. Ghosh had visited the man's family in September, but they'd already lost contact with him. Ghosh says he was struck that so much of the reporting about the crisis was depersonalized, about oil and arms, not people. He wanted to write about a single person who was trapped in the war. I asked him why his friend went to Baghdad in the first place.
I think he went for much the reason that any other, that most Egyptians go, which is that, you know, he'd finished school, he'd finished going to college, he'd done his military service, and now he was left with a degree. And really, there was no employment for him anywhere in Egypt. So he just needed a job, and he went. And in this period, you know, around about 83, 84, 85, when Iraq began to recruit more and more foreign workers because, all Iraqi manpower was being directed towards the war with Iran, a lot of Egyptians went. And he was just one of a huge wave, People say that there were at some stages, there may have been up to, 1.5 to 3 million Egyptians in Iraq. And indeed, at the moment, despite the huge exodus out of Iraq, people still think that there's probably 750,000 Egyptians or so still living there. So in a sense, he was just impelled by economic necessity. The whole Egyptian community in Iraq was really impelled by economic necessity in that way.
Now, his cousin also went to Iraq to work, and his cousin returned before the war, but your friend wanted to stay a little longer and make a little bit more money. I want you to read something from the ending of your piece, An Egyptian in Baghdad. And this is the part toward the end where your friend's cousin has returned to the village, and you're talking with him about what life was like in Iraq, and you ask him about Saddam Hussein.
Okay. Saddam Hussein, he rolled his eyes. You have to be careful when you breathe that name out there. There are spies everywhere, at every corner, listening. One word about Saddam and you're gone, dead. In those ways, it's terrible out there, though of course there's the money. But still, you can't live long out there. It's impossible. Did you hear what happened during the World Cup? Earlier in the year, Egypt had played a football match with Algeria to decide which team would play in the World Cup. Egypt had won, and Egyptians everywhere had gone wild with joy. In Iraq, the hundreds of thousands of Egyptians who lived packed together, all of them young, all of them male, with no families, children, wives, nothing to do but stare at their newly bought television sets, they had exploded out of their rooms and into the streets in a delirium of joy. Their football team had restored to them that self-respect that their cassette recorders and television sets had somehow failed to bring. To the Iraqis, who have never seen anything like a normal political life, probably never seen crowds except at pilgrimages, the massed ranks of Egyptians must have seemed like the coming of Armageddon. They responded by attacking them on the streets, often with firearms. Well-trained in war, they fell upon the jubilant, unarmed crowds of Egyptian workers. You can't imagine what it was like, said Ismail. He had tears in his eyes. It was then that I decided to leave. Nabil decided to leave as well, but of course he always needed to think a long time about everything. At the last minute, he thought he'd stay just a little bit longer. A little later, we went to his house to watch the news on the color television he had brought back with him from Iraq. It sat perched on its packing case in the center of the room, gleaming new, with chickens roosting on a nest of straw beside it. Soon the news started and we saw footage from Jordan. Thousands and thousands of men, some in trousers, some in galabeyas, some carrying the television sets on their backs, some crying out for a drink of water, stretching all the way from the horizon to the Red Sea, standing on the beach as though waiting for the water to part. There were more than a dozen of us in the room now. We were crowded around the television set, watching carefully, minutely, looking at every face we could see. But there was nothing to be seen except crowds. Nabil had vanished into the pages of the epic Exodus.
I think it really does change the way you see the refugees coming out of a city or the people being bombed in a city when you know somebody there, someone who you're worried about, who you care about. I guess that's what you're doing with this piece.
Yes, that was really my intention. You know, it's a very curious thing for people who know the Arab world, you know, or you know, Arab culture to some degree, that, you know, there's an enormous kind of Arabic literature, you know, and say, you know, there were really good Arabic novels written in the 1920s and 1930s and so on. But somehow these novels have not found their way into world literature, you know. I mean, I think India has been much more successful in portraying its literature abroad. And this is, you know, in a sense, when you look at the way that this war came about, to my mind, it seems that there's really profoundly a failure of culture there, you know. A failure of culture on the Arab side, in that the Arab side has really not been able to communicate with the world outside in the ways that I think most Arabic-speaking people would want. But equally in that, say, people like me or people who know the Arab world have really been completely incapable of providing, you know, the people who live there a face, an image of ordinariness, you know, which is, after all, what the Arab world is composed of, just ordinary people, you know, like you or me or everyone else. I mean, different in their own ways, of course, but people with very ordinary ideals, very ordinary ways of carrying on their lives. So, you know, I remember when I left Egypt in September, I mean, I was already writing this article then, suddenly it struck me that, you know, when I read these newspaper reports, when I read this sort of really completely dehumanized language that was applied to the Middle East, it really struck me that, in some sense, what we were encountering there, what I was seeing there, was profoundly a failure of culture.
Have you heard from your friend? Do you know if he's gotten out of Iraq?
I have no means of knowing. No, he still hadn't in September, so I have an uneasy feeling that he hasn't. I think he's probably still in Baghdad.
Is it kind of typical for people in one Arab country to travel to another country to get work? Do people, you know, migrate a lot between countries in the Arab world?
Yes, there's been enormous migration since about the 70s. But, you know, there's an odd kind of sort of dialectic there, really. Because, you see, the Gulf states, traditionally Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and so on, in many ways, you know, although their stated policy is what they call, you know, hiring more and more Arab workers, in fact, they've tried, or at least they've left it open for private entrepreneurs in their country to hire more and more workers from other Asian countries. So, in fact, one of the largest suppliers of labor to the Middle East, to these Gulf countries, is in fact India. I think Pakistan comes a close second. But there's a real reason for this, you see, because when you in a country like that, when you get large groups of, say, Egyptians or, you know, Syrians or Moroccans or whatever, in a way, they have a greater stake in the country. They have a greater kind of political impact upon that country, and of course, they often also want to stay longer. You know, they want political rights. They want you know, those human rights which you know, any migrant expects when he goes to other countries. Whereas when they get people from, say, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, who go there on very short contracts and are sent back pretty soon, that whole range of issues is completely shut out. And I think that's one of the real problems that lies behind the current crisis.
You were saying that it's really a shame that people in the West don't know Arab literature, and that it would really help us understand Arab culture, and that, you know, we're missing out on something.
Yes.
And you said that you thought it was a failure of the Arabs, that we didn't know that. In what respect do you think it's an Arab failure that the literature isn't known in the West?
Well, I think, say, one of the failures is really that, you know, so much money in the Arab world is spent on, on armaments, on, you know, on all kinds of things like that, on cars, on consumer goods, and so little is really spent on, you know, on film, on good films, on good books, on, you know, publishing good books, making them widely available. And, you know, it's really a crying shame because, in fact, you know, one of the oddest things about the Arab world is that I think in the West, people think of, say, you know, Arabic literature or Arabic culture as being something which is sort of somehow, you know, very old-fashioned or something like that. And in fact, you know, the Arab world has had the first modernist movements of any country in the Third World. I mean, they were writing the most incredibly, controversial, radical, really exciting books, you know, in the 20s and the 30s, and none of that ever seems to sort of get out into the world outside. And one of the reasons for that is, of course, again, that the money in the Arab world on the whole is controlled by very conservative, very traditional people who are not really willing to spend any money at all on cultural things of any value. I have some friends in Egypt, for example, you know, who are extremely talented filmmakers. It's almost impossible for them to get funding for their own films. You know, let me just give you one example. I think one of the finest films last year was a film made by this Egyptian director, a very famous Egyptian director called Yusuf Shaheen. It was called Alexandria Again and Again. And really, you know, it's an astonishing film. It's a film which really takes on the whole question of, you know, personality cults in politics in the Arab world. It deals with it really frontally. Now, you know, this film was just completely neglected. I don't think it's even been released in America. It's been released in Europe, but I don't think it's even found a release in America. And it's really an astonishing film. Now, I'm sure if Yusuf Shaheen were to make a film which had lots of camels in it and, you know, a sort of Bedouin and so on, it would find instant release all around the world. So the Western world has really chosen to reinforce its stereotypes about the Middle East.
Amitav Ghosh is the author of the novels The Circle of Reason and The Shadow Lines. He spoke to us from Station WMRA in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Coming up, a talk with Admiral Eugene Carroll of the Center for Defense Information. This is Fresh Air. Last night, Baghdad Radio announced that Saddam Hussein had ordered the Iraqi army out of Kuwait, and he was calling on the UN to declare a ceasefire. This morning, President Bush called the statement just more hype and said that Saddam must personally and publicly accept all UN resolutions calling for an unconditional withdrawal from Kuwait. So the fighting has continued. At a briefing this afternoon, the Pentagon announced that it does appear that the Iraqi forces in Kuwait are in full retreat. And some experts are projecting that the end of the war may be near. We called Admiral Eugene Carroll of the Center for Defense Information. Saddam Hussein wanted his troops to be able to retreat with their weapons. President Bush said soldiers retreating with weapons would be treated like combat units. I asked Admiral Carroll if it was reasonable to expect that we'd let them retreat with weapons.
In the present circumstances, it is improbable that any adversary would permit the enemy to withdraw from the battlefield with all of their weapons intact. This has been a terrible confrontation, and it came to this violent level. Having gone that far, then it's understandable that one party wants the other one to lay down their arms and leave the battlefield after they've been defeated.
When a war ends, does a country ever retreat with its weapons?
Oh, there have been many, many, many wars settled over the course of history in which scarcely any damage was done on either side, and the one who considered themselves a loser was permitted to withdraw with full dignity and in good form and with weapons. The idea of the unconditional surrender, in which one party simply abandons all identity and all control and surrenders to the other party, is a rather new idea in warfare. It's almost of this generation, of this century, and believe me, there are certain very serious shortcomings with the idea of unconditional surrender.
What would the disadvantages to the victor be?
It is generally accepted that one of the few mistakes that President Franklin D. Roosevelt made in World War II was to insist upon unconditional surrender of the Axis powers. In the first place, it sustained the war. We had to keep fighting, and we lost a lot more lives than were necessary. In the second place, it gave the Soviet Union much more time to advance from the east and to take over a good part of Europe that they might not have been in had we negotiated a settlement months before the final surrender. You cost lives, you spend treasure, and you produce political circumstances by a demand for unconditional surrender that can often be avoided by a well-negotiated settlement of the war on less than unconditional surrender terms.
The United States is asking the Iraqis to lay down their arms and retreat, and the United States says that the coalition forces will not fire on Iraqis who have laid down their arms. On the other hand, there is no ceasefire. Is it reasonable to expect soldiers to lay down their arms when there isn't a ceasefire? I know that adversarial soldiers watching the soldiers lay down their arms wouldn't shoot at them. On the other hand, this is a war in which there's missiles getting fired from quite a distance, and the people firing those missiles might not know that there were unarmed soldiers about to get hit by them.
Well, this is right at the crux of the problem. If we are so insistent upon this action by Saddam Hussein personally to signal an end of the war before we will stop firing upon Iraqi forces, then the forces in the field, which might be very well inclined to cease hostilities and to get out, aren't going to take that action. If you expose yourself on a battlefield, particularly to aircraft, which are just looking for motion, looking for forces that are exposed to air attack, you put your life in immediate jeopardy. What is needed is a brief period for the signal to go that we're not attacking any longer, you are free to withdraw. Anytime we saw any effort to use such a hiatus to reinforce, resupply, repair, strengthen Iraqi military forces, we would not be obligated in any respect to respect that action. That could be attacked directly and repeatedly. The fact is, the administration is so determined that this will be an abject and humiliating surrender by Saddam Hussein that it is interfering with efforts to resolve the situation on the battlefield and to make it possible for the Iraqi troops to withdraw in safety.
The United States now has troops in southern Iraq, and there, too, I think the conditions are the same, that the coalition forces wouldn't fire on retreating soldiers without their weapons, but would fire on retreating soldiers with their weapons. Now, we're not talking about a country that Iraq has invaded any longer. We're talking about Iraq itself. Is there any reason why the conditions should be different in Iraq for how the military and its weapons are treated?
Once again, we're in the fog of war, the fog of the battlefield, and no force well inserted in Iraq is for a moment going to tolerate anything that looks ambiguous or threatening. Therefore, how the ceasefire, if it comes, is to be implemented with respect to coalition forces well in Iraq. It isn't just southern Iraq. It's almost to central Iraq now. I don't know. Signals are going to have to be unambiguous and the actions clear so that we can disengage, get our forces out with complete safety and assurance that Iraq is not using the opportunity to reconstitute its forces and attack our retirement.
Do you think the coalition forces have virtually already won militarily?
Yes, the air war undoubtedly sapped both the Iraqi ability to defend and their will to defend. Their will and leadership is totally lacking. The overwhelming force directed against them has turned into just a walkover in military terms. It's a question now of being less arbitrary and less pedantic about the meaning of words and getting on to the outcome that we want, which is an end to shooting and killing and the complete withdrawal of all Iraqi forces from Kuwait.
But don't you think that the coalition forces want more than that, that they want probably an end to Saddam Hussein and an end to Iraq's military power?
This is yet to be determined. Clearly, an end to Saddam Hussein is far beyond the UN resolutions. This is where we get into very difficult situations. Iraq could comply with the most important UN resolutions, 660 and 678, and Saddam Hussein still remained fully and firmly in power in Baghdad. If we say that part of the outcome has to be his dismissal or his elimination, then we're changing the objectives, and we're also probably changing the military requirements. It might even be necessary to go all the way to Baghdad with military force to be certain that Saddam Hussein is removed.
If there are no big surprises left and the war ends soon and the coalition forces have achieved a very clear-cut military victory and a very swift victory in the ground war, do you think that we'll be left with, a kind of unrealistic image of war? Where you go in, you do the job very quickly, very few people get hurt from your side?
Yeah, absolutely. This war is going to exorcise the ghosts of Vietnam. We lived for a long time with the image of a feudal war being fought on and on and on for no political or military purpose. This very rapid, violent war is going to communicate to the American people, oh, yes, we can use military power successfully and for benefit. And this war in the Gulf is going to be cited as the justification for a strategy which maintains American service personnel all over the world ready to go to war in any local situation where we think our interests are threatened. And believe me, if we mindlessly buy into this strategy that the U.S. is the world's policeman and Iraq proves we can do it, we're going to be tying yellow ribbons around trees for years and decades to come.
Eugene Carroll, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for calling.
Retired Admiral Eugene Carroll of the Center for Defense Information. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, David Halberstam tells us that the war in the Gulf is distracting us from America's real problems, a growing rift between rich and poor, decaying cities, poor education. Halberstam's new book, The Next Century, is about the end of the American century, the century of American dominance. We'll also discuss press coverage of the war. Halberstam won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from Vietnam in the early 60s. David Halberstam coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush says that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's latest announcement calling for Iraqi troops to pull out of Kuwait will not end the Persian Gulf War. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush delivered a frank and angry assessment of Saddam Hussein's recent move, reflecting the administration's deep mistrust of the Iraqi leader. The president told reporters this morning in the Rose Garden that Saddam's recent speech was an outrage.
He is not withdrawing. His defeated forces are retreating. He is trying to claim victory in the midst of a rout. And he is not voluntarily giving up Kuwait.
Mr. Bush said the only way to stop the bloodshed is for Iraqi troops to lay down their arms. The president praised American armed forces and said the coalition's efforts are ahead of schedule. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The Pentagon says that the Iraqi army is now in full retreat, but that some units are battling advancing Allied troops. According to Lieutenant General Thomas Kelly, a tank battle near Kuwaiti City's international airport died down as darkness came. And he indicated that Iraqi forces might be pulling back there also. Despite glowing battlefield reports, a Pentagon spokesman said that while the Allied forces are ahead of schedule, the war is not over yet and a lot of things could happen. Pete Williams says so far, Iraqi forces have not used chemical weapons against Allied forces. On Capitol Hill, members of Congress today continued their expressions of support for the American effort in the Persian Gulf, with more and more lawmakers calling for the removal of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Bush has widespread bipartisan support on the Hill. After a meeting at the White House with the president, the minority leader in the Senate, Robert Dole, said that Saddam Hussein should not be let off the hook. Dole said that was the view of most American people. And other lawmakers, too, reflected the feelings of their constituents that Saddam Hussein should be punished. Democrat Bill Bradley of New Jersey said the Iraqi leadership should not be allowed to avoid accepting military defeat. Conservative California Republican Dana Rohrabacher called for the assassination of Saddam Hussein. But House Speaker Thomas Foley said he didn't think the president planned to pursue the war until Hussein was removed from power. Foley said it would be better if Saddam Hussein were judged and punished by his own people. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Police in Berlin report that one of several attackers opened fire on a downtown hotel this evening and threw what appeared to be grenades into the building. There have been no immediate reports of injuries. Police say that there have been no arrests and damage appears to be minor. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 23 points to close at 2,864.60 in active trading. This is NPR News. In New York City at the UN, officials say that most Security Council members want Iraq to promise in writing to honor all 12 Council resolutions concerning Kuwait before there's a ceasefire. The U.S. and Britain are leading efforts in the Council to force Iraq to comply with all the Council's demands, including liability for war damages and for any war crimes that have been committed. Both countries could use their veto power to head off any attempt to declare a ceasefire in the Persian Gulf War. Voter turnout may hit a 20-year low in Chicago today, where incumbent Mayor Richard Daley is considered the front-runner in the Democratic primary. From Chicago, NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
The Chicago Board of Election Commissioners lowered its projected voter turnout from 57% to 49% based on the number of Chicagoans who cast ballots earlier today. Daley, who won his office in a special election 2 years ago, established an early lead in opinion surveys over Cook County Commissioner Danny Davis and former Mayor Jane Byrne. Three candidates in the Republican primary aren't expected to pose a serious challenge to the Democratic winner. The lopsided race and the Persian Gulf War have diminished interest in the election. Chicago voters are also choosing a city clerk and treasurer and aldermen in all 50 wards. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
In Capitol Hill, some lawmakers are critical of the Bush administration's plan to add an extra $100 million into the nation's unemployment system. Critics say that the plan falls short of what is needed to help people out of work and to speed up payments of benefits. States have asked for at least $200 million to help process unemployment claims, which have grown along with the nation's unemployment rate. But Labor Secretary Lynn Martin defended the president's plan, which she says is adequate. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The military has established tight press controls during the Gulf War that are very controversial among journalists. My guest David Halberstam won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the early days of the Vietnam War for the New York Times. He was one of the first journalists to challenge the upbeat picture of the Vietnam War that the American government was presenting to the public. Halberstam also wrote about the war in his book The Making of a Quagmire, and he wrote about the rise of media giants in his book The Powers That Be. Halberstam's new book, The Next Century, is about the end of the American century, the century of American dominance. It picks up where his previous book, The Reckoning, left off. The Reckoning compared the American and Japanese auto industries, analyzing how the Japanese had surpassed us. Well, before we talked about the next century, I asked Halberstam what he thought of the military restrictions of the press during the Gulf War.
Well, I think obviously from the very beginning there's been an attempt to control the news of the war. I think we live in a wired world, and on both sides, on all sides now, I mean, the importance of television is becoming clearer all the time in terms of government process. It was sort of, I suppose, the last lesson of the Vietnam War. I think the military has, and the administration has, misread the Vietnam War. I think there is a sort of post-Vietnam belief that the press coverage hurt the military and cost us what would have otherwise have been a war that we would have won there. I think that's, as Barry Zorthian, the former chief press officer of the American Embassy in Saigon, pointed out on Nightline one night, that is a canard, that what got us into trouble in Vietnam was not a bad press corps, but a bad policy. But I think there's been a belief that they have got to control the press, and I think so much of this struggle has been over, is really not about print, it's not about even radio, it is about television and about who owns or who deploys the cameras.
Why do you think it's television that the military is most concerned about?
Well, because I think pictures are enormously dramatic because they are afraid of two things from the pictures. One, the impact, I suppose, of pictures of the devastation we might cause to the Iraqis or to Iraqi civilians, the impact of that on people in other parts of the Arab world or in the Third World or even in Europe. And they are equally uneasy about pictures of casualties, as of American casualties shown to the American people. I mean, I think there is an instinct to want to control events and to control perceptions of events. That's part of, I suppose, a normal struggle in a democracy, but it's made all the more powerful because we live, you know, in the Vietnam War, we didn't have satellites. When I was a young reporter there, let's go back slightly in time. I mean, television reporters were a minor presence in 1962 and 63. They were a couple guys who were former UPI reporters, one of them Peter Kalischer, who lived in Hong Kong, came over periodically, went around like print reporters, sent their film back to Hong Kong from whence it was shipped to the United States, where it vied for time on a 15-minute news show that was done in black and white. Well, gradually the pace picked up and it was soon done in color. But even by the end of the Vietnam War, it was not done by satellite. I think the immediacy of satellite is a new dimension. And the other thing is, I must say, as someone who's critical of network television, that I think that networks have earned some of this criticism and this lack of trust, that they have been so obsessed with dramatic footage, with footage that has action news. They so little deign to cover ordinary foreign policy, foreign events, which show small incremental change, that they have really created, among other people, working reporters such as myself, a belief that they are essentially isolationist, that they really don't care about serious of foreign news. They care about impact and about ratings. And that as the quality of the technology has gone up, the quality of the editing capacity, the ability to balance the visual with the non-visual, has gone down. So I don't have great admiration for the people. I don't have quite the respect for the networks I used to. I mean, I have great respect for network journalists like Garrick Utley or Charles Corral, people like that. But I mean, the 22 minute news hole is utterly inadequate, and I don't really believe that they're as serious as they should be. Think of how little they did in the way of covering the rise of Saddam Hussein. Think of what a poor job they did in covering the Iran-Iraq war. Think of the frenzy they went into to cover the American hostage case in Iran when the Ayatollah took the hostages, because it had pictures. I mean, I think they're really very mentally lazy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist David Halberstam, and his new book is called The Next Century. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. David Halberstam is my guest. Your book, The Next Century, kind of picks up looking ahead after the American century, after the century where America is the dominant force in the globe.
Yeah, it began with the first Henry Ford. We had cheap oil, and he found a way to do mass production of a car so that the worker became a consumer. And that is the beginning of the American century, much expedited by the fact that twice within 20 years, European nations waged total war upon each other, devastated each other, and out of that vacuum, America became the ascending superpower.
Well, your point is that those days are over.
They are over. They are clearly over.
Do you think that the war we're fighting is based on America being in the American century when we no longer are?
I think there are a lot of other things that I think we have not come to a realization that we are no longer in the American century. I think we are still, I mean, I think we there's a kind of almost political paralysis that refuses to realize that we are no longer in a period of American economic hegemony. And I think one of the interesting things and one of the dangers about the Persian Gulf War, two things about it. One, the very act of the war delays America confronting a much more serious agenda about its own future, about, you know, how well it's going to do, how solid its economy is. I mean, that's the first problem ahead. The second thing is that it seems to me that there's going to be an inclination on the part of our society, many people in it, to say, hey, we're still number one. We are powerful. We are where we ought to be. We're doing well. And not to understand that quick flash of American military might in the Persian Gulf does not represent grave, serious social and economic problems at home. That it is a thin veneer of military might and does not reflect more grave problems with the society.
So even a great success in the Gulf could serve to just distract us from our real problems.
Well,
of education.
Well, I think it makes us think that we're more powerful than we are. It is, I mean, it's an application of extraordinary technology. I mean, of bombs that are smart and are laser driven and seem to be able to go around buildings and right in the right office and whatever. But what's true is, I mean, and I talk about in the book, I mean, America has diverted so much of its energy because of the Cold War into its military arsenal and so much of its talent into designing weapons. And meanwhile, along come people like the Japanese, and they are diverting the same amount of energy into the consumer economy. And suddenly the Japanese have a very healthy economy and we have a more vulnerable one. I quote in the book a very distinguished Japanologist at Cal San Diego named Chalmers Johnson saying, "The Cold War's over, the Japanese won." And I mean, and there's an odd, terrible truth in there.
Well, how do you think the Japanese won?
Well, because, I mean, they haven't really won the Cold War. I mean, that's a bit of a joke.
Oh, I get the joke, yeah.
But, I mean, what it really means is that they came in under the American military umbrella. They wasted nothing in defense industry. Their most talented people went right into the consumer industries. And as such, they have done very well because they are unburdened by this factor of a huge defense industry, which sucks at the real resource of a society. I mean, some of it is mandatory. You've got to have a defense industry of some sort. But the clear feeling is, I would think, that it is out of whack, that this society is out of whack in terms of its priorities. I mean, we have bridges and highways that are tearing apart. Our industrial base is being undermined and is eroding. Our governors go almost on bended knee to Japan to get the Japanese to locate factories there. I mean, we're a troubled society. Under the veneer of the success in the Persian Gulf is of a society that is increasingly a two-tiered society.
Well, you compare the cities to being part first world, part third world.
Yeah, well, they already are. I mean, they're already. I mean, a city I live in New York City is a first world, third world city with less and less middle class. And I think we're in danger of having a declining middle class. One of the points I make in the book, I talk at some length with Lester Thoreau, the quite distinguished economist, Newsweek columnist, and I guess he's the head of the Sloan School at MIT, and we're talking about this because I see that great social fluidity in that broad middle class that I knew in America in the 40s and 50s and now even in the 60s beginning to erode. And he agrees, and he says, well, you know, when I read in newspapers, I hear Japan referred to as having an establishment, and Latin American countries always referred to as having an oligarchy. An oligarchy, as you know, is a few people who have great economic power but don't share it very much. And he says, you know, does America have an establishment or an oligarchy? And he ponders this question, and he says, well, after World War II, clearly we had an establishment. That is, we had a handful of people who came from an upper class and knew that if America were to be mighty, the wealth had to be shared. You had to open up your universities, your prep schools, your factories, your whatever. And we've had that, and we've had an oligarchy from time to time. The question now, and in the Latin American countries, there really is a small handful of people who think as long as they're doing well, it doesn't matter whether the rest of the society does well. And he says, in comparison, in Japan, I mean, the Japanese, he says, are probably just as selfish as the people who lead that society as any other country, but they know in a country as crowded as that, for their own children to do well, the children of other ordinary people have to do well. And the question now, he said, is America moving towards an oligarchy? And I think it may well be. I mean, an oligarchy, by the way, in which position is granted by basis of access to elite education. And that, if that happens, you are going to get social dynamite because you are not only going to get people who are not going to live that well, but they're people whose parents lived better and who themselves can, in their own lifetime, track a declining place in the society.
You know, I think last year when Eastern Europe broke away from the Soviet Union, that it was perceived as the victory of America, of American capitalism in the Cold War. You don't really see it as America's victory.
No, I see it as a great victory for the people who live in those countries, the end of an incompetent Russian Empire, which, and I think Russia is viewed now. I mean, one of the things that you could do in that great moment when it happened was pull aside the curtain, and you could see that Russia was a military superpower, but an utterly incompetent society, economically, socially, and politically, that it was a barely developing society and all other things, that it could not, in the most basic, elemental way, answer the needs of ordinary citizens. You go to Russia, and there's a one McDonald's hamburger shop there, and they have a line six blocks long for it. I mean, you know that's a country that's got problems. It's a country that can't truck a tomato from Georgia to Moscow. As a friend of mine says, the thing the country needs to be run by is Federal Express delivery system. And I mean, I think the collapse of that that empire in Eastern Europe is a great victory for the ordinary people of that society who held on to a better and different vision of life for more democratic society, whether it's Valencia in Poland and the Solidarity people and people like Adam Michnik and others, whether it's Havel in Czech. I mean, all those ordinary people who, subjugated by the Soviets, always believed there was a better possibility. It was not a victory for us. I mean, it may be a victory in some ways for the West Europeans and for the Germans, the West Germans, because they, I think, are going to be the next Japan. They're going to be the economic and perhaps the political beneficiary of these changes. They are going to fill the vacuum that the Soviets have left. But it is not about a victory for capitalism. American capitalism, as it exists now, after a decade of pillaging by people like Milken and Boesky and a lout like Donald Trump, I mean, needs to be much more balanced, much more entrepreneurial, less manipulative, less leveraging, and more invested in really making things. I mean, we have a lot of problems at home. I mean, these great victories come, and we are not in a particular position to be the beneficiary of these events economically. I mean, our heroes of the 80s are a really sad lineup.
Do you feel that we're in a time now when the map of the world in terms of power is about to be completely rewritten?
Well, that's why I called it the next century. I mean, I think that all the essential parts of the equation of what we've known for 40 or 50 or even 60 years in this society have changed. The Cold War is over. Russia is unmasked as a limited military power with great economic problems. It is pulled back from Eastern Europe. American economic hegemony is over. We do not automatically make everything better than anybody else in the world. The nature of work has changed, and it has really been changed by the Japanese, who brought a definition of economic power in which it comes from the maximization of the human brain rather than from material resource such as oil.
Where do you see America fitting in the next century?
Well, I have a great long-range faith in the common sense and the pragmatism of the American people. I'm old enough. I'm 56 years old. I lived through World War II, and I watched us go from almost isolationism and the destruction of our Navy and our Army at the time of Pearl Harbor to the enormous superpower success of America at the time of the Battle of Midway. I think it was only 7 months later. I watched us grow out of the Depression. I'm a child of the Depression. I watched us come back from a bad war in Vietnam. I think we are living over our heads and being self-indulgent now and pretending we still have economic hegemony when we don't. But I have a great capacity in the society as being regenerative, of being pragmatic, of American. The ability of American people to reinvent themselves, to be what they want to be, and I think that gives us great assets. I don't see any one nation rising to the replacement of what we were from the 40s to the 80s. I think that's kind of a fluke created really more than anything else by the aftermath of World War II. And I mean, I think that's an unusual and illusory version of power, that one nation would be for a time so rich and powerful when all around it are so weak and pessimistic.
My guest is journalist David Halberstam. More with Halberstam in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, the Pentagon says the Iraqi army is in full retreat. What do you have on that?
They say that more than 2,000 Iraqi tanks have been destroyed and that most of the fighting is over stale pockets of resistance, still possibly a big tank battle to come. There's some celebrating in Kuwait City. It is somewhat liberated, the Iraqi troops, most of them anyway, having left overnight. Saddam Hussein, in a radio broadcast from Baghdad, promised Iraqi troop withdrawal from Kuwait. Some of that appears to be going on, but President Bush has declared that message on the radio to be an outrage. The Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations says that Iraq will not comply with all the UN resolutions. We'll have reports on all these matters tonight.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Journalist David Halberstam is my guest. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the war in Vietnam. His new book is called The Next Century. It's about the end of the American century. You know, you've mentioned in your book how you were always politically informed, but it wasn't until you started writing about Japan in the 1980s that you really had to get an economic grounding.
I was an economic illiterate, like most journalists of my generation.
Well, you know, I think so many people, especially people who came out of the humanities in one way or another, really didn't learn economics very well.
I don't think it's about not learning economics, Terry. I think it is coming to young manhood. I graduated from college in 1955, and that meant that American economic success and strength was a given, and therefore it was never even an issue. The question was really, how do we carve up this pie? And that was the issue. And it wasn't that I was from the humanities. It was that it wasn't an issue. And now it is an issue.
Yeah.
And the next generation, the younger people the young journalists in their 30s are much better economic reporters than people like me who are in the mid-50s or people even older.
Well, how do you think you've been changed by no longer being an economic illiterate?
Well, I think you have a much better capacity to read the politics of this country, because if you read the politics just as an end in itself, you get caught up in effect a dumb minutiae. But if you have a sense of eroding economic underpinnings, then I think you understand the edginess of American politics and why it doesn't face real issues in its quadrennial election and why, you know, it's afraid to. It's uneasy. It's edgy. Issues like the Pledge of Allegiance become the dominant issue, or abortion becomes the issue. I mean, issues that really are much more ancillary to what the American agenda is, and it's because we're afraid to face these realities. Nobody's really going to debate it, and we cover them up with tricky little sound bites, and therefore we postpone the real hard decisions, and we become a nation that continues to live over our heads. And that, I mean, so it's made me, I think, infinitely better a political reporter.
Now, earlier today, you were very critical of how television has covered events over the years.
Over the last 10 years. I think it's the gap between the cumulative news judgment of the major national newspapers and of the networks, I think, has widened all the time.
But I bet you're still pretty addicted to the TV coverage of the war, and that you'll be
going home to your
hotel room or apartment
junkies
or whatever and watching it, right?
Yeah.
And you'll be frustrated.
I mean, I watch
as you
every
watch
night. I mean, if I can. I mean, that's a natural addiction. It's a compelling event, but it's also only a part of the American agenda. You could win this war and not only not do well in this peace, but you could watch an America slowly, systematically erode and become a second-rate society, educationally, and therefore, in the long run, economically as well. And the networks could easily miss the story. And they're missing the story right now.
David Halberstam, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Journalist David Halberstam, his new book is The Next Century. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Our production assistants are Joan Tuohy and Roberta Sherrock. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai about war, love, and God. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.